Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll first speak with former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, Paul Glastras, to get a sense of what the still popular former president might deliver tonight in his keynote speech at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. Then the popular radio personality and commentator Jim Hightower joins us. He, along with 20 prominent Democrats, wrote an open letter to the Democratic leadership, how Democrats can get back on offense. And we will discuss the letter and how it was received, as well as review the First Lady's widely praised speech and what former President Bill Clinton will bring to the convention tonight. Then finally, following the announcement by the UN that over 100,000 refugees fled Syria in the month of August, we will speak with Gillian Schwedler, who is a specialist on Jordan, where most of the Syrian refugees are ending up in UNHCR tents in the blistering hot desert. We will get a sense of how the fragile kingdom is handling the ongoing humanitarian disaster next door and how Jordan is still coping with the massive influx of refugees from the last war in Iraq. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, who is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I take it you're not the author of tonight's speech that Bill Clinton will be giving before the Democratic Convention in Charlotte.
No, my understanding is that President Clinton is the author, or at least he and his unnamed staff and speechwriters were hard at work down to the very end working on it.
Well, that's apparently the way it is with him, isn't it? Everything is...
Absolutely. I'm reminded by my former boss, chief speechwriter Michael Waldman, in a story in the New Republic today that when he spoke in 1996 at the Democratic Convention, that his motorcade was pulling into the venue, and the helicopter, the news camera from the helicopter zoomed in, and there was the speechwriter Michael Waldman with the laptop, glow of the laptop, very visible on screen, typing away on the speech, literally tweaking it at the last minute. And the announcer said, this is a lesson to all you kids out there. Don't wait to the last minute to finish your homework.
So, Paul Glastras, what do you think the Obama team want from Bill Clinton tonight? What do they expect and what do they hope?
President Clinton is probably the best communicator, in our lifetime, certainly, maybe ever, of substantive policy information. No one is better at boiling down complex policies and ideas and programs in language that anyone can understand, and doing it in a way that is balanced and fair, and yet, obviously, as a politician, framed to do maximum damage to the opposition and maximum benefit for his side. I think what the main thing that they're asking, that he's going to do, is, in addition to his very presence advertising that the last time a Democrat was in the White House, the economy went through a rare and wonderful period of growth in which income at all levels of society grew. The main thing that he's going to do, I think, is frame and be specific about the policies of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. We went through a campaign, a convention last week, the Republican convention, in which dozens of speakers over 3 days spoke, and I don't think any American got a specific sense of what a Romney-Ryan policy agenda is. It was all, we're going to cut taxes and we're going to strengthen Medicare and we believe in a woman's right to choose and so forth, but really no specificity at all. And I think what the president is going to do is bring specificity to it in a way that will be, I think, accurate but also appalling to a lot of Americans.
So President Clinton is He's in his post White House life with his foundation, etc. Has become an elder statesman and has reached out to former President Bush Sr. With a lot of bipartisan efforts in Haiti and other places. So it's not likely, I would imagine, that Bill Clinton will be throwing red meat to partisan Democrats, right?
Oh no, I don't think it'll be red meat in an angry or a vitriolic sense. I think he's going to stick to a, as I said, a description of the choice that faces the American voter, and he's going to get specific about what it is the other side is aiming to do with their plans. Put it in layman's terms. He's going to then say, this is what Barack Obama has done and is aiming to do. Here's why you ought to choose Barack Obama. I think it's going to be an informative speech, obviously weighted to Obama. It's going to be an argument. I don't think he's going to say nasty things about Mitt Romney. Quite the contrary. I think he'll say he admires his business acumen and his family, and he's a good American, but that his policies would be disastrous, and if you want the same economy or something like it that we had in the 90s, choose Barack Obama.
So how is the Bill Clinton? Well, do you expect Paul Glastras, again, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and from September 1998 to January 2001, he was special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. Now, curiously, the famous line from the 92 campaign that elected Bill Clinton was, it's the economy, stupid. That's largely been expropriated now by Mitt Romney. They're running on it's the economy, stupid, and hoping that enough people will be upset with the economy that they'll vote for them. So it seems to me that one of Obama's challenges has always been how to not own this economy that George W. Bush handed him. And a part of the reason why we had that crash in 2008 was to do with Bill Clinton's getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. So do you expect any kind of mea culpa in the context of giving the Democrats clean hands about the economic disaster that befell us in 2008?
So I guess I'd say, first of all, I'm not sure that getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act had much of anything to do with the crash. I mean, it probably wasn't a wise thing to do. It was, the Glass-Steagall Act was so full of holes by then. It didn't amount to much, and I think the idea that it had anything to do with the crash itself has been largely debunked. But sure, it's the case that the pro-financial policies that were carried out in the 90s and then advocated by some Clinton administration members, subsequently in the aughts, contributed to the general financialization of the economy, which was part of the environment in which this housing bubble and the subprimes and all that happened. And I wouldn't be surprised if President Clinton acknowledged that he and lots of other people were not attuned enough to that and contributed to that. I can see him doing that.
Well, as you know, the Occupy movement, for example, Paul Glastras, that has been about the only manifestation of protest against what's happened to the economy, apart from the Tea Party, which in a way is still mystifying to me how they were able to run away with anger at Wall Street and create this kind of AstroTurf movement that in many ways is being at the bidding of a handful of billionaires. I've never understood how the Democrats lost the populist rage at what happened on Wall Street. I'm just wondering, you know, for example, if there was a strong message about that, and I think it's clearly the subtext. It was the subtext of the speech last night by the First Lady, you know, showing compassion towards those who have been affected by this economy. And so many people have subsequent to it, and particularly in the Occupy movement, have basically said a plague on both their houses because they both get money from the same people. So I'm suggesting here that maybe that a way to differentiate the Democrats from the Republicans in terms of the direction the country's heading into a plutonomy controlled by oligarchs might well be good medicine.
Well, I think Barack Obama has a record that if you know, I would urge him to run and be proud of and speak about even tonight of having essentially re-regulated Wall Street along the same patterns and in the same basic ways as FDR regulated Wall Street in the 30s, and having created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which if the president doesn't, is reelected and has a chance to protect it and it grows, has the potential to really change the business model of finance in this country so that banks are in the business of lending people money when they need it so they can grow their wealth and get ahead rather than through predatory loans that essentially sap people's wealth. So, you know, I think that against a united front of Republican opposition, the president passed reasonably tough and quite comprehensive financial reform, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that the Republicans want to gut. And it's something you ought to be proud of. And it might not mollify some folks who thought it didn't go far enough and didn't break up the big banks and so forth. And, you know, we can have a debate about that, but it was a considerable achievement. And, you know, the jury's not out on it, but the profits of Wall Street are down. And a lot of the proprietary trading offices at the big banks have been shut down. And the honeypot of profits are being dried up and bonuses are down. So early signs are the thing's working. And that's something to run on.
Well, I think Paul Glasser says no question that at least the framing of the 99% versus the 1% is an enduring political fact. And I don't think you could have a more tailor-made representative of the 1% than Mitt Romney.
That's right.
And my sense is that President Obama ought to make those distinctions and raise the alarm about the growing disparity of wealth in this country. If you have a situation where just one family in America, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, have a fortune that's equivalent to the entire wealth of the 40% of the bottom in America, it's an appalling fact.
You know, I think that we saw it this summer in some of the ads that not just the Obama super PACs, but the campaign itself ran against Mitt Romney about the actual record of Bain and the empty claims of job growth and the shutting down of the steel mill and the rapaciousness of private equity. I think that had a tremendously powerful effect. You apparently saw it in the Obama campaign, saw it, the Romney campaign saw it in internal polling. A lot of other polling picked up. He was going to run on being Mr. Business Fix It and a private equity guy, and he in August more or less abandoned that because of the success of that attack by President Obama. But I think what you're going to see now is a subtler, and we've been seeing it this week, right, at the Democratic convention, a subtler argument than what you just laid out. It's along the same lines, but it's one that essentially says an economy. There are two visions of the economy. Right, there's the top-down, cut taxes for the wealthy, and the rest of us will benefit version, which is the Republican view, and then there's the middle class out. Whatever helps the middle class helps the economy view, and that's the Democratic vision. I think that gets across some of what you're saying, but does it in a way where you don't necessarily, as a voter, have to agree with the larger plutocratic arguments that you're making, which resonate with a lot of people, but don't resonate with a lot of people.
So, Paul Glasras, just back to tonight's speaker, your former boss, President Bill Clinton. You wrote over 200 speeches for him. Apparently, we're told that the conventional wisdom about the American electorate, where the center decides, is no longer the case. That we've become so polarized that the center doesn't really matter. And I'm just wondering, one, whether that's true, and whether Bill Clinton could go after the undecided, who might well, if persuaded, vote for Obama.
So it's certainly the case that a number of people who are truly undecided has shrunk over the years. There's still a huge swath of Americans that say that they're independent, but when you actually look at their voting patterns, they almost always vote for one party or another, and the independent is really just a label. But when you look at the people who are likely to vote and yet that might not have, that have not made up their minds, it is a vanishingly small group. It's maybe 7% of the population. And then you look at the states where their votes, with a number of votes that small, might make a difference, i.e. the swing states, and you're talking about 7, 8, 9, 10 states, maybe fewer. So we're talking about a universe of 1 million to 3 million people, right? Those are the people who are going to decide the election, and there are not a lot of them. But when you get one of them, you automatically rob the other side of a vote. So they're twofers. Whereas if you just get one of your already decided voters to the polls, that's just one vote for you. So that middle voter is still very, very important, and is hugely important in the swing states. So any good convention speech has to both gin up the enthusiasm of the base and be appealing to a persuadable voter.
Well,
and that's where the skill of writing these things comes in.
Well, Paul Glasras, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasras, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and he's a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. And before joining the White House, Paul Glasras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Jim Hightower.